across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Well, a podcast that's been going now for nearly 17 years. Coming up in March, it will be the 17th anniversary of The Unexplained. The whole thing started quite slowly and quite bit by bit. Quite trepidatiously, really. I've never done anything like this before, and it was you who suggested that I should do this as a podcast. So I think at the beginning I began with a podcast a month and then increased it to what it has become today. And I was talking at the beginning of this to a lot of the guests who were spoken with, interviewed by, conversed with by Art Bell in the United States. I used to contact those people and put them on the radio in London. And when I started doing the podcast, those people came with me. People like Linda Moulton Howe, Michio Kaku, the famous science man, and also the guest we're about to catch up with on this edition of The Unexplained, old friend of mine for 25 years or more, Richard C. Hoagland. Always charming to have on, always unique, and always, of course, controversial. Not everybody agrees, and I know this, and he knows this too, with everything that Richard Hoagland says, but he's still there, and these days, of course, doing his radio show and podcast, The Other Side of Midnight. He was one of the stalwart guests of Art Bell's Coast to Coast AM, and I can remember in the late 90s when I got my first computer, listening to Art on Coast to Coast AM, thinking how cool it would be to do a show something like that. But with a bit of a newsy twist and a bit more science in it, which is what I'm doing now. But also listening to the regular guests and thinking I'd like to speak with those people. And in a lot of cases, I did get to speak to them. People like Al Bielik from the Philadelphia Experiment, and Edgar Mitchell, of course, the late Apollo astronaut, and the man that we're about to catch up with now, Richard C. Hoagland. The man, of course, became famous for the Face on Mars story at the middle or the end of the 1990s. The famous view of what appeared to be some kind of artifact on the surface of Mars. And Richard has continued in that vein, of course, for decades now. And continues to do so. He's in his late 70s now. I don't know whether he would thank me for telling you that. But I've known him for a very long time. And I remember when his late partner Robin and Richard came over to London, I remember taking them to near Hampton Court, not far from where I live. And then we drove in a car that they'd hired. And I think we're still learning to drive into central London where they were staying. And then we had dinner on the South Bank, not far from the old London Television Centre, London Weekend Television, in the pouring rain. And it was quite an experience. And Richard was very generous with his time. And also, of course, Richard and I had experience of the Beyond Knowledge Conference in Liverpool about 2008-2009. Some recordings, of course, on the website, theunexplained.tv, still there from that. Richard gave a presentation about the rings of Saturn and other things. And I was impressed by the fact that Richard could stand there and deliver a presentation without notes for a couple of hours. I think he spoke solidly for about 2.5 hours. And I just thought this is one of the best presenters of material that I've ever come across. And I still think that all these years on. So Richard Hoagland, the guest on this edition of The Unexplained, thanks as usual to Adam for his continued work on the website. Thank you to you for being part of this show. No shout-outs on this edition apart from to Catherine. Catherine, thank you very much if you're hearing this for your memories of NASA. Very grateful to you. You worked at NASA. Well, you know that, but I'm just telling my listener that. And you sent me some recollections of what it was like to be there. So, Catherine, thank you very much indeed. And I'm really pleased that you're listening. If you want to get in touch with me, wherever you are, please tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use this show. You can do it by following the link at my website, theunexplained.tv. Let's get to the guest now in Albuquerque, New Mexico, as ever, Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, nice to have you back.
Well, Howard, welcome back yourself. It's been, what, years since we did this?
I think it's been very nearly, or as we say in the United Kingdom, the thick end of 3 years, Richard. And I think a lot of stuff has changed in our lives.
Tell me about it. You know, Robin dying really put me into a tailspin, and I've been trying to, you know, maintain normal work and life and all, and it's impossible. Whoever tells you that you get over this, no, you don't. It's like a scab that is always there, and we had so much together that we can't have now. So,
but anyway. They tell me, and you know, I hope that this is true, that one of the most, I certainly find this with my parents, who I was very close to, and of course I've lost both of them, and they were my guiding star. As I know, Robin, having met two of you together in London, you know, she was your guiding star, but the memories are very sustaining.
Do you remember that extraordinary night in the rain along the Thames restaurant?
I recorded the intro to this, and I referred to it. I mean, that was just an astonishing London night that we experienced.
Amazing day together, and then ended up in this beautiful restaurant by the Thames,
yep,
on the western side, I think. And we spent this gorgeous evening together, and that's been one of the memories I've thought back on, the things that we did together, and you and I and she did together.
You know, it was a lovely night, and we literally, in that rain, we reenacted Singing in the Rain, because it was like a scene from that movie, wasn't it? You know,
it really was.
The only thing we weren't doing was dancing, but we were certainly laughing a lot. We covered an awful lot of ground.
And we kept looking for restaurants, and they were all closed.
No, I don't know. I still don't know why they were all closed. Maybe it was the time we arrived or whatever. But I do know that you were both, you know, learning to drive that British car that you had.
Oh my God! Yes. Yeah, we almost killed ourselves a couple of times.
I know, I had to guide, well, as best I could, because I just don't drive in London anymore. I gave up years and years
ago. Well, you have public transportation.
Yeah, I've got a car, but I don't use it. My car takes me out of London, but it doesn't take me into London anymore. The last time I went into London, Richard, was my dad, when he was still alive, came to stay in London over a Christmas. This is probably 2011, I think, maybe. Mm. And I went to the, you know, this is only a tiny little apartment, so he wasn't staying here. He was staying in a nice hotel a little way away from here. And I went to him and I said, let's go into London. It was Christmas night. And we drove, because the charges that they levy on you now for driving into London weren't applying on Christmas night, so I took him round all the places that he would have known when he used to come down from Liverpool as a young police officer and, you know, sometimes do service down here. I took him all around those places. It was a magical night. But I don't drive. The long story here, cut very short, is that I don't drive in London anymore, because it's just financially and in terms of the hassle factor, it's not worth it, as you indeed discovered.
Do they have a tax for driving, or is it parking?
Oh, we've got you name taxes, we got them. And we're going to get something called the ULEZ, the Ultra Low Emissions Zone, that I understand the reason for, but it's coming out into the suburbs effective August this year. And an awful lot of people who don't have the very latest vehicles, an awful lot of people who've got businesses and stuff like that, can't at the moment in this recession afford to reinvest in, you know, greener technology, are going to find themselves paying.
Well, given, you know, what our government's been doing, given what Biden did with the infrastructure bill and then the other one, there are huge tax subsidies for people who switch from gasoline to electric. I mean, and the electric technology is now there. You don't have to wait for it.
Yeah, no, it is there, you know, for those who can afford it. I can't.
Why you need subsidies. That's why the government has to help people.
Well, I'll tell you what, they're going to have to heavily subsidize me if they want me to change to an electric car, because I haven't got that kind of dough. And also, where I live, like an awful lot of other places, let's not talk about anything political, though, Richard, please. Please, please, please. Otherwise, the emails will start. You know, the fact of the matter is, the nearest charging point to where I live, God knows where that is. But I'm sure all of that's going to be sorted out. And, you know, whenever I ride in a taxi that's electric, it's always a lovely experience.
Well, it will be sorted out if there's enough public pressure to sort it out. That's what happened over here.
Yeah, well, I think we've got too many other problems at the moment, but please let's not go down the rabbit hole, because we know where that is.
Well, actually, the rabbit hole is connected to some of the incredible breakthroughs in our research we're going to talk about. So there is a interconnectivity to life and to technology and to research and to getting around cover-ups, which have forced us to live in kind of like the Stone Age. You know, the idea that we're still pumping fluids out of the ground and burning them and creating huge problems for the atmosphere, et cetera, is archaic. It's not necessary. And I'm not talking just about the normal alternatives like wind and solar and whatever. I'm talking about sticking instrumentation straight into the torsion field itself and tapping off unlimited non-polluting energy that you turn into electricity, and the cars don't care how you charge them. It's the source of the electricity which is the problem, not the end use.
Is this the stuff that Art Bell was getting into?
Yes,
this
yes,
great big antenna.
Well, it's not even an antenna. It's something the size of a bread box that you'll someday buy and stick in your basement or in your apartment house, and it taps into it goes by several different names. The mainstream name for it is the zero point energy of the vacuum. Mm. It's really tickling the torsion field. That's the Russian term for it because of Nikolai Kozarev's incredible research into torsion, meaning rotation. Remember, anything in torsion is rotating, flexing. And one of the keys to tapping into this is rotation of mass in three dimensions. And then you process it artificially and you tap off the energy. And this has been part of the huge cover-up because of oil lobbies, oil companies, oil monopolies, you know, what they used to call special interests. Mm. Well, special interests are killing us and the planet and a huge number of people, and that's why it's got to change. And we think we've got now a handle on the breakthrough that will politically, and the only way it's going to change, Howard, is politically change it.
All right. Well, that's this was the surprising news you told me about in an email, yeah?
One of.
All right. Well, we'll get to it.
Yeah.
I want to just update our listener on a couple of things because I've got new people joining this all the time, right?
Excellent.
I didn't.
By the way, we ought to be able to promo my show because a lot of this. We're going to talk about this coming Sunday, the 29th. It turns out that your show precedes my show.
My TV show, yeah.
Which is available all over the world through the internet, the magic of the internet. And so we'll tease what we're going to talk about on your show, on my show, and then on my show I show images and data and pictures and links and research, and we talk about with a panoply of generalists what this will mean for Britons, for American citizens, for the entire world, and in the not-too-distant future. It'd be one thing, Howard, if we had to start from scratch and invent everything like Edison and the light bulb. Mm-hmm. No, all we got to do is open the doors and have all this secret technology that the so-called deep state has been hiding for decades out into the open and available commercially, and we can go to the races day after tomorrow. The transition can be swift and almost painless, except to the lobbyists and the oil companies who've been keeping us down on the farm.
Okay, well, I've got a lot of questions about that for you, but I want to get to other stuff, okay? First of all, the definition, the introduction to you. For people who've never heard you before, I mean, I've got the bio here from something I found online. One of the things we've said before is, by the way, my listener, don't look at your Wikipedia entry because it will seriously mislead you. But this is your bio. Richard C. Hoagland, former Space Science Museum curator, former NASA consultant, and great claim to fame during the Apollo missions. You were science advisor to the great Walter Cronkite at CBS. And
there's one thing
that was just the start of the story.
Yeah, there's one thing we should add. It turns out, and I haven't thought about this in so long, but I was doing some research the other day. It turns out that I actually have a small role, official role, under NASA in the Apollo program. I was officially part of the Apollo program, and let me tell you how it works. When I was at CBS one afternoon, a guy came up to me and he said, Mr. Hoagland? I said, yes. He was kind of tall and wore one of those suits back in the 1970s. He said, I need to talk to you. So we went into a quiet office, and he closed the door, and he says, we would like you to write the Grumman press book section on the moon and why we're part of it and part of Apollo and why we're building the lunar module. And I looked at him, and I said, what? And it turns out that's exactly what happened. So what we'll do after we tape this is that I'll send you a link to the actual Apollo press book from the Grumman Aerospace Corporation, which describes in a whole chapter in the press book that went all over the world. Every press person on the planet covering the Apollo program had to read the press book, and they obviously read my section on why we were going to the moon. And, you know, as a writer, Howard, it you know, you look at your stuff very, very, very with slitted, narrow eyes because you always hate what you write. I got to say that after 50-some years, this damn thing still holds up.
Did you get a name credit for this?
Yeah, of course. My name's right on it.
Good.
I'm in the table of contents. It's all official. So I will send you that link. You'll put it up on wherever your audience goes and listens to. But no, you can add to my credit that I had a little tiny part of the actual Apollo program in helping humans go to and return safely from the moon.
The world of science, the world of space exploration, the world of just about anything that's cool and interesting is always spurred forward by people who are not afraid to say controversial and unusual things. And that's what you've done over the years. But
you mean square pegs and round holes?
Yeah, I do. I was trying to put it in a nice, finessed English way, but that's exactly what we're talking about here. Now, when I said that you were coming on this show, I posted it on Facebook. I got some messages, and it's the usual divide between people who are loving the idea of hearing you again after, you know, a certain amount of time and people who are saying, "That's the guy from The Face on Mars. What happened about that then? That was discredited, wasn't it?"
No.
In 2023, do you have anything to say about The Face on Mars?
Oh, yeah. The Face on Mars, the Cydonia region of Mars, after its discovery and then suppression back in 1976, is literally, and people can go and look up the statistics if they have the, you know, stomach to and the fortitude, it is the most photographed region by any and all space agencies that have ever gone to Mars with unmanned spacecraft on all the planet. If there's nothing there, boys and girls, why did NASA and the other agencies, the Chinese, the Russians, the Japanese, the Indians, why did they all take more pictures of the face on Mars and the surrounding pyramids than any other region of the planet? Answer, it's all real. It has incredible, profound meaning for humankind. And it's part of what they, the deep state, if you want to call it that, have been suppressing for, you know, over half a century because they dare not let us know. Because if they do, then everything will change, mostly for the better, and they will be out of power. And ultimately, it's all about power.
Well, a lot of things these days, I think, are about power. Hanging on to power and making the most of power for yourself, I think. He said controversially, but, you know, there are those who
it's
will tell...
It's not controversial. It's plain as okay. Anybody can look at the TV screen and see all the strange, you know, stupid petricks going on. It's all about power. It's not about serving people. It's not about serving humankind. It's not about human progress. It's not about making, you know, haves out of have-nots. It's all about power by those who can get it and keep everybody else from having it.
Well, if you'd said that to me 10 years ago, I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, I might have said, no, 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 I can show you a million. And now, I don't know, there's a big area of doubt in my mind, unfortunately, and I'm just hoping that I see things in the future that make me feel less that way. But let's try and veer away from, you know, the party political as much as we can. It was me who took you down this road. But in terms of the face on Mars, is the face on Mars not just, as some people claim, the greatest example of pareidolia, that is, your mind making an image where there isn't one, that there has ever been?
No, it's not. And it's very simple. I mean, I wrote several books on this, bestsellers, The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever, The Secret History of NASA. Just go find them, read them. You know, we track the research meticulously, step by step by step, by all the normal tenets of science, logic, mathematics, you know, checking with independent researchers, other people looking at the same data, coming to the same conclusions. The face on Mars and what it means is there for anybody who has got an open mind to look at. Now, there's been this incredible drumbeat for decades against this research, not just by me, but by anybody who would, you know, look at this seriously, because if it's taken seriously, it changes everything. When you go to another planet, either in person, which no one's done that yet, but Musk is coming up the rail. Look at what his technology is doing that everybody said was impossible. He's going to get humans to Mars decades before NASA or the Russians or the Chinese or whatever. I guarantee it. It's called the free enterprise system. Anyway, what's waiting at the end of that road that Musk is pioneering is non-governmental humans, civilians, who will not have signed any NDAs. Those are non-disclosure agreements, who will be under no legal compunction to not tell the truth. And when they land at Cydonia and start wandering around and picking up junk and stuff and bits of technology and go inside, because these structures at Cydonia are huge artificial buildings, the Italian architect back in the 60s coined a term for these kind of structures. He called them arcologies, for architectural ecologies. He even proposed in the same year that we landed on the moon in 69 that cities on the earth, so that the countryside could go back to natural nature, replenish itself, that we dome in, that we close in cities like New York and Los Angeles and London and Rome and whatever. And he called this process building a huge multi-million person arcology. Well, with the unmanned spacecraft back in 76, Viking looked down and photographed from a couple hundred miles up these pyramidal structures arrayed in an amazing geometry next to this huge mile-long, 1,500-foot-high effigy of a face we found on another planet where you would need it, because the environment of Mars outside is terrible. You can't remember Elton John? Not the place to raise your kids.
It's cold as hell.
You need an arcology. If you're going to have millions of people living on Mars, you need them inside some kind of huge building. Well, these structures on Mars arrayed in their stunning geometry are basically human-made, huge, artificial city-type structures, now millions of years old and in ruin and decay. And that's what we tripped over. And the fight for the last, 30, 40, 50 years. I mean, I started this back in 1983. Mm-hmm. The fight has been to get the government to acknowledge what the data from the earliest missions have shown. And that's why I think we're on the verge of a major breakthrough, because politically, we're now so close to everything changing, because the artificial nature of someone constructing things on other planets is not just on Mars. It's all over the solar system, as we've seen from other NASA missions. But most important, it's right in our own backyard on the moon. And again, it's a private entrepreneur named Elon Musk and SpaceX and nine artists, including, I think, a couple from Britain, one who's a photographer, I'm not mistaken, who we're going to instruct in what to look for, what to photograph, and in the next couple of years, when they make their turn around the moon in the starship that Musk is building, they, citizens who have not signed any NDAs, are going to blow the doors off this incredible cover-up, and then we are in a totally new paradigm.
Assuming that's going to happen, though, Musk is working with NASA at the moment. So why would he, if he's going to be the person whose pioneering efforts are going to blow the lid on all of this stuff, he wouldn't be free to do that, would he? If he was working with NASA and there was a cover-up, then he would have to be part of it, wouldn't he?
Well, he's working on two tracks, right? Mm-hmm. He has a contract with the Artemis program.
Yeah.
Remember, they just sent the Artemis mission on an unmanned journey for 26 days, looping orbits around the moon and returning to Earth to test all that technology. He has a contract to develop the lunar lander as part of Artemis, okay? He has a separate program, his own, SpaceX, to take under contract now nine artists who have been selected, whose names are now public, public events. And they are going to go separately from NASA on a Starship, on a looping orbital mission around the moon and back to Earth, sometime at the very end of this year, most likely because of the technological developments required, sometime in 2024, which is a good year, at least a year, maybe longer, ahead of the Artemis mission. So I think it's going to be nine civilians looking out the window and taking all kinds of imagery with digital cameras and sending it home on Twitter. Who just bought Twitter?
Well, he did. He's having his
problems
with
Twitter,
it.
That's why he bought Twitter, Howard. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So he has an iron-proof, ironclad, bulletproof way to get the data all over the human race and all over the world, and no one will be able to legally stop him or touch him, and that's his grand plan, and that's why he looks like he's crazy right now. No, he's crazy like a fox.
Well,
he knows what's out there. How do I know? Because one night, your audience should love this, he and Joe Rogan, you know who Joe Rogan
is? Yeah, the Joe Rogan Experience, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Joe Rogan and he sat for like half an hour talking about Richard C. Hoagland and my work. And Rogan even had a copy of one of my books to show on screen, which, of course, was all part of a plan. There are two forces at work here. There's the cover-up crowd and the, I'll call it as Haldeman did, the limited hangout crowd. Musk is in the limited hangout crowd, as is Rogan. The cover-up crowd are NASA, the government, all governments, by the way, because they've all signed on to this. The British government, the Japanese, the Indians, the Russians, all of them. Otherwise, it would be somebody else who'd blow the doors off. It's going to be civilians in Musk's civilian starship, which is rather fascinatingly named, kind of ahead of its time. It's going to go, you know, looping around the moon, and we're going to provide them with the keys to how to see and photograph and indomitably record all the stunning artificial structures that are there. And we're going to debut all that this coming Sunday night on The Other Side of Midnight.
I mean, I'd love all of this to be exactly, you know,
it is
true and bona fide. I want it to be so, but we'll see what happens. How come I haven't? If Musk is mounting this mission with the artists and stuff like that, now maybe I've just not been diligent as
I
should be.
You didn't know that this they've already selected the civilian astronauts?
It somehow passed me by. Maybe I did mention
it
en
passant.
Oh, my
God, it's been in the Mail and in the London Times. Just Google Musk's nine, and there are nine of them because it's spearheaded by a genius, multi-billionaire, Japanese recording artist. I forget his name. But Musk basically, he made the deal with Musk to take him and eight friends around the moon. And then Musk let him, in turn, pick the other eight artists, which were announced just a few weeks ago, one of whom is a very illustrious British photographer. She has won awards. She's innovative. She's not of the normal stripe. In other words, you know, simply buying the government line. If we equip her with the right tools, which is the technology, the camera, the filters, most important, and the wherewithal, the background, to know what to look for, there's no way they're going to keep her quiet.
Okay, I've got an article here from the Independent newspaper, which, you know, I like the way they write and stuff like this. 2018, Elon Musk rocket company sending a Japanese billionaire and eight artists around the moon in the first private trip to our nearest neighbor. So I have mentioned this, but it was 4 years ago it first appeared in the media.
They've now picked the astronauts, and he just, the other day he had what was called a wet rehearsal of the Starship complete rocket and spacecraft at Boca Chico, Texas.
Okay, so you're saying that this is how we're going to get a big surprise through this mission.
Stunning breakthrough. Unless the South Koreans, which have sent a 1,500-pound unmanned spacecraft into lunar orbit, and they have equipped it with cameras which are taking pictures of the glass domes on the moon, even as I speak, and they're leaking them all over their website, but they're just not holding a press conference. They put out the images, they even brief the press on the images, and they don't say what the images show. And of course, the world press these days are so damn dumb and stupid that unless an authority figure stands in front of them and says, "This is what you're seeing," they haven't a clue as to what they're seeing.
So how come, sorry I'm jumping in here, but how come the Artemis missions, the SLS was developed for them, Orion we've just seen successfully test itself out, how come all of that stuff is going ahead on schedule, as we say over here, when there is another truth about the moon that is going to be blown wide open. I mean, how come these two things
are... It all has to come together. Yeah. Howard, it all has to come together. We're within months, not decades, not years. We're within months. If you consider 24 months, 2 years to be a reasonable time frame of months, we're within months of it all coming together and everybody knowing. The question now is going to be who blows the doors off first? Will there be an official party line? Will it be civilians? Will it be totally unmanageable folks like us? Who's going to get to define the parameters of what is there, what it means, and how it's going to change humankind? That's where the war is now, because they've lost the cover-up. In fact, I'm going to lay out on my show on Sunday how in 2024, in the summer of 2024, we have a total solar eclipse that literally crosses the country again. And it's not going to cross, you know, we're not going to have an eclipse for the Americans, total solar eclipse for like decades afterwards. It's the last chance, unless you want to travel somewhere. I'm going to lay out in the next several shows, because we can't do it all on Sunday, how ordinary civilians with ordinary optics, cameras, binoculars, telescopes, can photograph these artificial structures on the moon with their own commercial technology, and we will have thousands of independent observers and photographers from Earth who are going to give us a stunning preview of what the nine civilians in Musk's Starship lunar mission are going to see in the next couple of years. We're on the edge. On the edge, Howard.
I find it all very exciting, but I know that there will be listeners to this right now, and you know what I'm going to say, because I have said it before. I find it exciting, and I'd love to see this happen. And there will be people who will say, yeah, I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, they'll see it.
Right, well.
All they have to do is wait 2 years. Now, a lot of people are going to do, after we lay out how to do it, and it's really simple, we'll take these images during the eclipse. And then they will, because we have this social media conflagration all over the world, all these TikTok and Twitter and Facebook and all these ways to get information to other people. Once you get people verifying this independently at the civilian level, at the citizen level, at the democratic level, it's impossible for the powers that be to keep the, you know, thumb in the dam.
But the powers that be are still investing billions of our dollars and pounds in the explorations that we've gotten, the helicopter up on Mars, the Artemis missions to the moon, and loads of other stuff, including the James Webb Space Telescope. Why is all of that continuing when you say a big truth, and a shocking one and a surprising one, is about to be unveiled privately or by private means?
Well, because research is not one thing. It's a huge panoply of things. It's, you know, the Webb telescope can't even look at the moon because it can't look back toward the sun. It would kill it. It would burn out the optics. So the Webb telescope has its role in a much larger research plan to educate and uplift humankind. The same with the helicopter on Mars. Why do you think they've been able to fly this thing so easily and for so long when all the forecast beforehand where it was going to maybe not even lift off the ground, and then it certainly wouldn't last more than a month or so, like three or four flights. Mm. Didn't you wonder why it's still going?
Well, I think it's been a great success. I think they had a couple of issues with it, but it's been
Why is it still going?
I don't know. I mean, I know
because
that the most
the environment
recent...
is much more benign than we've been told.
Okay, so if that's
Mars,
what's allowed them to
they've
fly.
They've been lying about the Martian atmosphere.
Right.
Decades.
So that's what's allowed them to, for example, the most recent missions with the helicopter have been to the upland areas, the hills,
yes.
Haven't they?
Yeah. Yes. Because the atmosphere of Mars is 10 times denser than they've been telling us for the last 50 years. I had lunch with the guy. His name was Calori in the JPL cafeteria back in 1971. This was after the 1965 mission of Mariner 4 to fly by Mars. I actually did a whole program from the museum in Springfield. Before I joined CBS, I was the curator of astronomy and space science at the Museum of Science there in Springfield. And I set up an international radio program, which was nominated for a Peabody. We didn't win. and the hours and hours have went gone into the ether. My friend Dick Bertel, fortunately, did a 30-minute edit of this program from 1965 when Mariner 4 flew by Mars, and we have that on record as to what we forecast back then was going to happen vis-a-vis Mars. Well, that mission, in addition to taking 22 black and white images and flying past Mars at 6,000 miles, it flew behind the planet as seen from Earth in a special experiment that was designed to pass the radio signal from the spacecraft through the atmosphere of Mars, both as it went behind on one side and came out on the other. Those are called occultations. And then they interpreted the changes in the radio signal to reflect the atmospheric density and pressure of the Martian atmosphere. That was the stunning NASA cutting-edge experiment in 1965, which was supposed to tell us to verify the density of the Martian atmosphere and give us some indication of its composition. And I now can prove that they lied, that from the get-go, NASA has been lying about the Martian atmosphere because they didn't want anybody to ever imagine that there could ever have been life on Mars, and certainly not people ever going to Mars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When this thing begins to unravel, Howard, there is no limit to the lies that we will find they've been telling, all to keep us focused only on Earth and not at all interested in what's out there, how it relates to our history, who we really are, the things we used to do, the stunning, incredible civilization that we used to be before we, quote, fell, before we retreated to one planet and have been clawing our way back up from, as Arthur Clarke used to say, the primeval slime. All of that's going to come rolling out of the closet because the days of the cover-up have run to their end. They've run out of things to do to cover up everything because there's too much technology, too many people leaking, and whole governments, like the South Koreans, have sent a spacecraft to the moon now, and they've been leaking real images of what's really there, and they just haven't said anything because they're waiting, obviously, for the appropriate political timing.
Now, if my more skeptical listener is shaking his or her head right now, I just ask them to just think for a second. And, you know, I have to be the ringmaster in all of this, and that's my job. Just think for a second about the astonishing stuff that has appeared in mainstream news in the last couple of years that we did not think was likely or possible. And ask yourself, if such things can happen, then who knows the extent to which the actual truth of what is out there might differ from what we were taught when we were kids. And you might surprise yourself. I want to ask you about one thing, if I could, quickly. I've got some questions from listeners here. Not very many of them, because it wasn't meant to be a question show. But Jonathan, regular listener to this show. And Jonathan, I can't ask all the questions that you sent because we would be here all night, but I want to ask this one. I've looked at this on your website today. You did a show about it last year, almost exactly a year ago. The Stonehenge transmissions. Now, I drove past Stonehenge just before Christmas. I stayed in Devon with my dear sister, and I drove past Stonehenge, and I always have to have a little look at the stones. I think they're very special for reasons that I don't think I'll ever really understand. But did you send transmissions from Stonehenge or receive transmissions there?
Yes, we did. And the gal that you need to have on your show, Howard, is Maria Wheatley. She's a Brit. Mm-hmm. She's not too far from you. She's done all this archaeology for us. We've been working with her for years. She took a handheld transceiver into Stonehenge, into the middle of Stonehenge, and we did several repeated experiments, both within and without, sending and recording what we got back. And her only problem is we haven't been able to successfully decode more than a fraction of the signals that we got back. We have a colleague in Canada who's been working on decoding some of this, and he's been partially successful. But by and large, it's a untapped field of research, which is why we need more funding. I mean, the Enterprise mission is basically on a starvation diet in terms of funding. We started this hoping that there would be people who would stand up and help us, And so far, no one has come forth, either because they are unbelieving of the premise, unbelieving of what our results were that we talked about on the show many times, and we actually played some of the signals, or simply they were, you know, kept from supporting us because, again, this falls in the category of those things where you're not supposed to ask questions and certainly not supposed to get any answers.
I think at one point you used a Morse code demodulator or decoder.
Yeah.
And actually received words that you believed were from the Gnostic Gospels.
That was David who interpreted it that way. The actual numerical codes were more believable to me. But again, this is a huge body of research that is kind of laying fallow in the last year or so because we didn't have the wherewithal and the right people didn't show up to help us. But again, it hasn't gone away. You know, it's not like we missed a window.
It's something that you could do anytime.
Yeah, we actually chose certain key dates in the calendar, like solstices and equinoxes, because that's why Stonehenge was built as this megalithic observatory, because in those parts of the calendar year, the physics is different than in other times of the year. And we were depending on the theory that whoever is out there, and there's a lot of folks out there, they know the hyperdimensional physics that I've been talking about for a very long time, and it would be the kind of like the modus vivendi to use that modality to talk to them as opposed to just ordinary radio transmissions. So that's why we picked Stonehenge, and we picked Stonehenge because in an earlier experiment where we sent electromagnetic transmissions to the moon from a private observatory in Arizona, we got answers back in the form of this radio code, quasi-Morse code, which gave us the numbers directly associated with Stonehenge. So it was like whoever we were talking to
was sending
us to Stonehenge to continue the experiment. So that's when we, you know, got Maria involved, and you should have Maria on because she recorded everything and she kept notebooks and logs. And so you would have a fascinating time.
If you
time.
Can send me those contact details, I'd be
I
very
I will send
very
you
very
her contact info as soon as we are finished with the program. Yes.
Now, listen, I told you I got some questions, and you know also that there are skeptics. So some of the questions come
from... I love skeptics.
Good. Well, let's
if
see.
They're if they're honest skeptics.
Let's see. Well, there is no reason to doubt the honesty at all of the people who ask these questions. One, Richard. I'll summarize the two of these together because it's Richard and Phil, okay? Richard basically asks why you've clung to beliefs based on old photographs that are just bad photographs, and Phil is asking why don't you just finally accept that the face on Mars is not real? Well, it's a thing. I mean, it exists. Whether it's a face, I think, has been the point in question. But, you know, two questions from two people from the same perspective here. You're clinging to old beliefs based on bad photographs, and Phil basically asking, you know, when it comes to the face on Mars, why don't you just give up?
Well, obviously, neither one of them have looked at our latest research, and we published it freely on the Enterprise Mission website and the Other Side of Midnight website. So it's not that I'm trying to make a buck on this. I'm trying to change human history and put us back on the path of progress as opposed to the path of suppression we've been on. The most interesting images of Cydonia, curiously, do not come from NASA. They come from the European Space Agency, from ESA, from the Mars Express imagery in color that Newcomb early on took a complete mosaic, high-resolution, stunningly high-resolution mosaic of the Cydonia region, including the face on Mars. And it's on those images that not only can you see details that are not available on the NASA data, gosh, I wonder why, but you see details in color and you see that at some point, some later high-tech civilization on Mars, after the original that built the face and the pyramids, the later civilization put some kind of a glass covering over it, and we can still see on Newcomb's European Space Agency imagery remnants of the glass because of the way glass scatters light and the color. So I'm not dealing with only ancient images from Viking. We have imagery which is, I must say, the European data is by far the best because it's by far the least censored. And unfortunately, Newcomb is no longer with us. He was the principal investigator of the German camera, which is still functioning and still taking breathtaking color imagery of Mars for the Europeans.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm here to be the ringmaster. We've said that, and we know, you know, I think my listener knows that. But all I can say is that these days we've got people you wouldn't have expected to say things like this, saying things like, for example, I interviewed on my TV show a few weeks ago, Professor Avi Loeb, postulating the possibility, you know, the man behind the Galileo Project.
Yeah, of course, Avi is avoiding me. He will not come on my show. If you can talk to him and have him come on the other side of midnight, I'd love to talk to him. Because he and I were the two independent scientists, he at Harvard, I'm not at Harvard, who said that Oumuamua was an interstellar alien extraterrestrial artificial probe, and I have data that Abby does not have that he needs for his model, because he independently said that based on his research, it was most likely an interstellar artificial probe.
And he indeed was brave enough to come out and, you know, suggest that. He also suggested...
It's not bravery. It's just telling the truth. They don't stand you up against the wall and shoot you for telling the truth.
Suggested,
what they do is they try to get you fired. They try to get you excommunicated.
Or defunded.
They try to get you... Well, that's basically excommunicated if you're a scientist who needs grants. That's why we now have things like GoFundMe and Patreon and whatever. The people can fund research apart from institutions and get answers that have lain dormant for decades, because no longer do we all have to feed like little piggies at the federal trough, which governs all the research that they will allow and eschews all the research they don't want you to know about. Read more letters. I love the letters.
As to questions... I think it's Jonathan who said, any thoughts on, and this isn't one that I was going to run past you, but let's do it just quickly. I always raise my eyebrows, and I'm always interested when the scientists come out and tell us where the doomsday clock is now. And as you might know, the doomsday clock a few days ago edged itself even closer to midnight. The doomsday clock is this representation of where we stand as a human species vis-a-vis and in reference to our possible demise as a species. And the doomsday clock has edged itself a little closer to midnight. I'm not sure how much closer, but, you know, a significant amount closer to midnight now because of all of the stuff that's going down in our world. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the reason the doomsday clock has been moved forward to very close to midnight, and this started... You know, after World War II, with the development of the atomic bomb here in New Mexico, I live north of, the test site down at Alamogordo and south of Los Alamos, which is here in northern New Mexico. The reason that the Citizens for Science, I forget who actually is the institution now that runs the clock, set it up is because they looked at atomic weapons and immature human beings, and they said the two shall never get together, and ultimately will make a fatal mistake, and bingo, there goes the neighborhood. They have moved the clock back and forth as the Cold War ebbed and flowed for decades and decades, and now you have a major land war in Europe, the first time in 70 plus years, Ukraine, and you've got a major leader of a major country, Russia, armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, tens of thousands, threatening every Thursday to use them in a way that has not been, you know, except for North Korea, de rigueur for decades. So no wonder that the scientists who are involved with the so-called, you know, doomsday clock have set it almost to midnight. So what's the solution? The solution is to open the system from being a closed system where we're all going mad just talking to each other, to encompass the solar system and beyond our ancient heritage, stunning technologies that make nuclear weapons obsolete, that make, you know, coal and oil and fossil fuels obsolete, that give us technologies to enhance humanity and to enhance the Earth as opposed to pollute it and destroy it, and who open the box So it gives us the technologies to take people into other environments, give them a whole new perspective on who human beings used to be, who they can become again, and make people like Putin obsolete.
So you're saying that the key to world peace is to lift the lid, open the sarcophagus or whatever it might be, the storage facility full of all of these secrets, which a lot of people have claimed for a long time exist, the secret to, you know, everlasting energy that's there for us for free, and all of those other things, to open...
Living much longer. I mean, what can you do with just a, you know, 4 score and 10 or whatever? Human beings should live much longer than we have been prescribed to live, okay? All kinds of medical technology, all kinds of physics, all kinds of fundamental research, all kinds of, you know, bringing the world to where have-nots have an equal chance with haves, where we're not fighting over a few scraps like dogs under a table with a feast on top that we can never get to. But the most important thing, Howard, that reconnecting with our history will give us is perspective on the fact that every human being on this planet is part of a family, a close-knit family, infinitely closer in relationship, in culture, in background, in perspective, in humanity, than what's out there. We need to restore the idea of a human family and get over the idea that just because you're Korean or Afghanistani or Russian or Hindu or Muslim or whatever, you're the other and you must be hated and you must be destroyed. We need something so big to replace the idea that we're all separate fragments at war with each other, with a common humanity in the face of astonishing potentials that lie just at the moon and are just now, within the next few months, within our reach once again.
So what is going to be the event that opens those floodgates and releases this information?
It's not one event. It's a series of events, okay? I mean, it's already started. The leaks have started. The South Koreans have published stunning images, which you have not seen or heard of or whatever. Why? Because they haven't called a press conference. We live in a world where unless an official sits in front of a camera and says, this is reality, very few people will get on board. And I think they're doing that because, going back to Brookings, remember the Brookings report that I've talked about, this ancient 1950s study funded by the U.S. government that basically said that if humanity ever discovered that it wasn't alone, it would destroy itself? I think for the same reason that Biden has been tiptoeing around supporting Ukraine with weapons that would really allow the Ukrainians to drive the invading Russians off, you know, Ukrainian soil because of fear of nuclear war, that they've been tiptoeing around the idea of extraterrestrials because of Brookings, that basically said if human beings really are unfettered in knowing that we aren't alone and that we have relatives out there and there are really aliens, we will destroy ourselves. I think that's been a lie. That's been propaganda, again, to propagate those in power who can be king of a closed Earth system and will fall by the wayside once the system is open.
Why do you think the new director of NASA, and NASA as an organization, is now taking an interest in UFOs?
Because he already knows they're real. Remember, Bill Nelson went into space. Bill Nelson had the, what was the book the guy in MIT wrote called The Overview Effect? Mm-hmm. Bill Nelson was a civilian astronaut on a shuttle program. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Now he's come back and he's head of NASA. He is doing things behind the scenes to architect this unveiling. Have you looked carefully at the imagery from the Artemis Orion spacecraft mission?
I know that that was heavily commented on a few months ago, yeah.
Oh, it shows stunning glass structure. You just have to know how to look. In fact, it shows data that supports Alan Bean's incredible so-called fantasy paintings of his sojourn back during Apollo 12 when he and Pete Conrad walked on the moon. You know that Alan Bean was an astronaut, right?
Yes.
And when he came home, he became this stunning, you know, fine artist. And he painted hundreds and hundreds of paintings. And they underwent a kind of transmogrification where we started out, you know, with the landscapes being dead and gray and black and white and all that. And then at some point back in the 1990s, all his lunar paintings of him on all the crews prancing around on the moon suddenly took on incredibly lyrical colors. He called this his Monet Moon. Why do you think, Howard, he did that?
I don't know, and I can't guess.
Because that's what he saw. And the blocks and the suppression of his right brain went away over the blocks and suppression of his left brain. And because he was an artist, whatever brainwashing the astronauts went through, and I have documentation that they were brainwashed. They were literally mind-controlled, so they didn't remember what they really saw and did. It came through him because he was an artist at heart. When he was in, Naval Flight School, he was doing art. So they took an artist to the moon. He comes home. His left brain is suppressed because of the programming, but it came out in his right brain art. And his art is stunningly beautiful and incredibly accurate. And on the Other Side of Midnight website, mm-hmm. You should give out our website, othersideofmidnight.com.
I saw it.
We've done the comparison of his lyrical paintings and the actual Orion imagery, and they look identical. Alan Bean's work is going to go through the roof, and we have had donated as a tax-deductible contribution to the Enterprise mission, one of Alan Bean's signed prints, signed by 24 of the Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and shuttle astronauts. And we're auctioning this off to the highest bidder, whoever donates the most money to our Enterprise mission research, to get this now out into public at every level we can. They will get this signed print, which is going to, escalate in price enormously as soon as everybody realizes, oh my God, Alan Bean, first artist astronaut on the moon as part of Apollo, it was trying from the 90s onward till his day he died to tell us and paint the truth about the real moon, which is a moon under incredible rainbow glittering glass prism effects because of the refraction of light from the sun through the layers of the domes.
Did he ever confirm that in his lifetime?
When I was giving my first major lunar briefing at the National Press Club back in the early 90s in Washington, D.C., I had a colleague who knew Alan Bean first person, was a friend. And after the press conference, my friend went to Bean and said, "Is Hoagland nuts?" And Bean said to him, "No, he's not." But of course, they would have killed him if he told the truth back then. Remember, they kill people. There's a huge litany of people who have died under very bizarre, mysterious circumstances.
Well, there's certainly a lot of stuff to be read online about people around the space program who have died and about
look at
whose
what
death
happened
questions
to Pete Conrad.
Have been asked.
You know the story of Pete Conrad, who was the commander of Alan Bean on Apollo 12?
Remind me.
Alan Bean and Pete Conrad landed on the moon in November of 1969 in Apollo 12, second mission after Apollo 11, after Neil Armstrong. And decades later, Conrad was going to give an address to a moon industrial conference in Houston. And he loved to ride motorcycles. And so he was out riding in California a couple of days before the conference with some friends. And he took a turn and he slid off the edge and he took a tumble. And his friends insisted that he go to a hospital to be checked out. I mean, he was a veteran motorcycle rider. Motorcycle riders know what to do on motorcycles, so that, it's like being an acrobat. You roll, you kind of roll with it. You don't resist it. He was a veteran. He was a fighter pilot. He'd been in all kinds of incredible dangerous situations during Korea and during, that thing after World War II. They take him to the hospital. He goes in and he dies. Mysteriously dies. He should not have died. What was he going to do 2 days later at the Houston conference? He was he was reporting that he was going to announce some kind of breakthrough that would make industrialization of the moon and this transfer of power upwards to the next level that had never been announced before. And I think he was murdered.
Now, well, that's a very heavy thing to
yes,
assert.
Of course it is. But, remember, they tried to kill me, Howard. They literally sat in a hotel room in Florida.
And
in
you had a heart attack.
I was given a heart attack through the wall by some technology. And Robin rescued me. And some advice I had from an old-timer decades before who told me what to do if anybody ever tried to do this also rescued me because I took steps in that hotel room before the beam could finish its work. But they gave me a heart attack. Afterwards, in the hospital, the doctor said, I don't know why you had a heart attack. You're in perfect health. Couldn't understand from the machines, from the analysis of my veins, my cardiovascular system, my heart, why I should have had a heart attack. Because it was induced. Well,
and I know you've said that on many shows, including some of mine, many times before. And, you know, I hear what you say. I cannot verify what you said about that case, the case of Conrad. You know, everything that I'm reading here, and I've got my computer with me, is saying that this was a tragic accident. But the accounts also say that he was wearing a helmet, crash helmet at the time, which you should do when you're on a motorbike, and was driving to the speed limit.
So Alan looked at that and said, obviously, well, I'm not going to come out and say what I saw, so I'm going to do it in my paintings. And his paintings, anyway, we have this fundraising campaign. We've got this signed print, 24 astronauts, a bean print, which is going to escalate in extraordinary value as soon as the world realizes what Bean was trying to tell the world, as will all of his other works, his other paintings. And he was very prolific, and they're stunningly accurate to what the imagery shows. I've got on our Other Side of Midnight website a side-by-side comparison of an astronaut photograph from Apollo 17 and then one of Bean's paintings side-by-side. And if I didn't tell you which was a painting and which was a photograph, you could not tell which is which. And what did I do to the official Apollo image of the surface of the moon?
You superimposed them.
No, all I did was turn up the color. The way NASA has been hiding all this is they've been suppressing the color. It's called desaturation. Now, why have they not merely made black and white images of the color images? Because then that could be that could be detected by outside observers, by scientists and photo technicians. So since 99.999% of people who look at these pictures never touch them in an imaging program, they don't know how, they look at them as presented, and they appear to be very colorful because you've got red stripes on astronauts, you know, spacesuits and whatever. But if you really turn the color up and color balance it with a white balance, which is the suit itself, bingo, you find that the moon is incredibly colorful in the photographs from Apollo as in the imagery that being painted in his paintings.
And sadly, he's not with us here now to ask about any of that, which is unfortunate to say the least.
But his work lives on.
But his work lives on, and you're going to be
And I have a feeling that there was an agreement among all the astronauts who were basically able to come out of their fugue and their funk and their programming eventually. And they realized what had been done to them. And they realized what would happen if they spoke about it out loud, because they are only an individual and the deep state has very long tentacles. But they allowed Bean to be their spokesperson through his art. That's why he ultimately went on to represent not just his own mission, Apollo 12, but Apollo 11, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. And I think he became the quiet spokesperson for the real moon from the Apollo astronauts, because the paintings could, like Emily Dickinson, tell all the truth, but tell it slant until the appropriate time. And that time is now. We are on a countdown to people being shocked by what is really on the moon and how they themselves can verify it during the eclipse in 2024 from Earth. They don't have to be one of the 9 civilian astronauts that Musk has selected, but those people will get a special educational archive from the Enterprise mission to prepare them for what they're going to see when, as 9 privileged civilians, for the first time in a very long time, they are going to get a chance to look down on the real moon, and we will outfit them with the right optics and the right cameras and the right technology so they can record what's really there and send it back to Earth for all the world through Musk's own Twitter.
So will you regard that as being the culmination of all your work over the years and the vindication of things you've been trying to say?
Good grief, Howard. It just begins. Wouldn't you like to find the libraries? Wouldn't you like to find what our ancient ancestors were trying to say and do as they created this architectural, stunning set of stuff? What their life was like, what their politics were like, what they thought of God and the universe and other dimensions.
And what everything. Was about. No, absolutely. Totally. And look.
Well, that's where things begin, because then the next mission, remember, the Artemis program is to land human beings, men and women, to establish a permanent lunar base at the South Pole, right?
Right.
Which will encompass more than just Americans. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the South Koreans are already playing and sending the right technology, the right cameras to take the right pictures to show the ruins, don't you think the South Koreans want to be part of the base?
I would suspect so.
Don't you think their main objective will be to find the libraries? And I got to tell you, based on the analysis of the imagery of the moon that we've looked at all the way from Apollo, all the way through the Japanese and the Chinese missions, the most protected parts of the moon where we're likely to find stuff still available is at the North and the South Pole or on the far side. It's difficult technologically with current rocket technology to reach easily the far side, but you can reach the South Pole, which is why that's where all the nations talking about going back to the moon are talking about landing. The problem is, if you try to land at the South Pole without knowing how to get through the remaining glass domes, you will crash. Which is why the South Korean mission, the spacecraft, 1,500-pound spacecraft, carries a 33-pound camera called a shadow cam from NASA. And they are photographing the permanently shadowed craters at the moon's South Pole for Artemis, so they can obviously see where the glass is and see where the holes are and land the spacecraft through the holes in the dome, of which there are many because it's very, very ancient, very eroded, very gossamer, like in certain areas. And it is possible to safely get down and back up, as Apollo demonstrated by landing on the near side at the equator, where the glass is thinnest and most eroded and basically has the consistency of cigarette smoke.
Well, all we can do with this, Dick, is wait and see.
It works like hell. We're not waiting at all. And our campaign begins this coming Sunday evening, 10 o'clock Mountain Time, 9 o'clock Pacific Time, on Sunday night, the 29th, on the other side of midnight.
Right. I'm trying to work out the timings, but that is early hours of the morning in the United Kingdom, after my TV show. All right. Just to conclude this, a couple of things that I don't know whether you're going to want to talk about this, but, you know, I promised that I would ask this. A listener called Tony in Spain said that apparently, and I haven't heard you saying this on the other side of midnight, but he's heard you saying that you've received signs and signals from your partner, the wonderful force of nature who I knew, Robin. Robin Falkov, Dr. Robin Falkov. Tony wants to know, could you explain what happened? Has this continued, the signs and signals, and did you pursue this with, I don't know, mediums or people like that? If you don't want to talk about this, that's fine.
I don't yet know how, Howard, to reasonably talk about it. It's very private.
Of course.
It's obviously very emotional. I didn't want to believe it in the beginning. It tells me that she's out there somewhere And if she's out there, then everybody else who, quote, dies is out there. This is why we need a paradigm shift. I am sure our ancient ancestors who built these stunning stuff all over the solar system knew so much more about life and death and what really happens. I'm coming to almost believe that we're living in an environment where it's broken, where we don't really know what reality is like because it's been artificially conscripted, maintained. We're kind of like in some kind of some kind of box, some kind of prison. Did you ever read the works of Charles Fort?
Mm-mm.
You know about Charles Fort?
I've heard the name and that's all. I've got to be
honest. He was a 19-teens, 20s, 30s newspaper reporter who would collect all kinds of anomalous stories from...
Oh, as in the Fortean Times.
As in the Fortean Times.
Yes.
And, you know, well, he wrote a book called The Book of the Damned, having nothing to do with heaven and hell, okay? In his purview, in his language of the time, the damned were those things that humans are not supposed to touch or know that are taboo. Kind of like censorship, mm-hmm. kind of like now when there's reality of the solar system and we're not supposed to know because whoever makes those decisions says, no, this is how we keep, you know, human beings down on the farm. Well, he wrote this book, The Book of the Damned, and his conclusion, and remember, he was a newspaper guy, he was a generalist, was that we were property, that some extraterrestrial force or agency or entity or entities, plural, kind of thinks it owns humanity. And it gives us, spoon feeds us, little dribs and drabs of a much larger, more extraordinary reality. Well, over the last 4 years, since Robin passed away, she has been able to give me some signs that that reality, that much bigger, this is what's really going on, is actually true. The problem is I cannot scientifically verify it, so it becomes just another, you know, story and million stories of the Naked City. I can't get independent scientific confirmation. I've been working on ways to do that, and part of it is kind of like looking at the totality of all the things that she has created and caused to happen to see if I can translate this for other people so that they can start seeing the same kind of signs in their own lives. And I'm not talking about mediums and channeling and past life regressions and all of that. I'm talking about something totally different. Mm. So I'm not really ready to talk about the details publicly. Mm-hmm. I have given, you know, obvious witness that this has been going on. I know it's her. I know it's her weird, wacky sense of humor. And I'll just have to leave it at that. But, you know, it's kind of like an unfinished something with more details to come.
Well, I think there must be a lot of comfort to be had from that. And I believe we go on.
It's a bittersweet because she's not here.
Yes.
And it's so awful. But at least she's somewhere.
Exactly. And I think, you know, like I say, there is some degree
and all
hard,
these
though this always
died
is of comfort.
COVID, this incredible wave of pestilence that has overtaken the human race, all those people are also out there somewhere. Mm. And I believe that part of what opening the door to our ancient past and our ancient wisdom and those ancient libraries are going to provide us is the fact that there is a key to connecting these two realities back together again, because I'm coming to believe, again, based on evidence that I can't detail because we don't have the time right now, that these two worlds were artificially sundered, and part of our mission as a human species is to put them back together, and the keys to that is what's lying on the moon.
Boy, I don't think I can add anything to that at all, really. You know, it would be pointless and worthless of me to do so. Thank you very much for bringing me up to speed and up to date, Richard. I hope I've done you justice. You know that you have people who support you and people who don't, and those people will be listening now. And that's just part of, you know, the experience of doing this. I've learned doing the podcast as I've done it over all of these years. There are people who like it and, you know, like the cut of my jib, as they say, and people who don't. And I've just kind of learned to rock and roll with all of it, really. And I think that's all we can do. If people want to check out, I can't believe that anybody listening to this now won't have done that already, but if people want to check out your body of work, where would they go online?
Well, theothersideofmidnight.com or the Enterprise Missions, plural, with an S, because someone stole the Enterprise Mission website. That was part of the... We're constantly under assault. You know, it sounds paranoid and ridiculous to say it, but we are. So we had to change the name of the Enterprise Mission for the web source, the URL, to Enterprise Missions with an S. But the primary flagship of what we're doing now is the program, theothersideofmidnight.com. And as I said, we're going to unveil this astonishing new evidence and how we're going to democratize this on this coming Sunday night, the 29th of January. For those in the United States, it'll be the 30th for you guys there in Britain, and it'll be starting at 9 p.m. Pacific, theothersideofmidnight.com.
Richard, good to talk with you again.
We must make it quicker than three more years, Howard.
I think so, too. Your thoughts welcome as ever on Richard C. Hoagland. Just as enthusiastic as ever he was, and every bit as controversial, I know you will tell me, but your thoughts welcome. Go to my website, theunexplained.tv, follow the link, and you can email me from there. More great guests in the pipeline, when hopefully it's going to be slightly warmer when I'm recording again. So until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained Online. And please, whatever you do, stay safe, stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.